Position number 12812, reel 1.
Mr. Hanley, reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
Bolton, Lancashire.
Which year was that?
1917.
What did your father do for a living?
Brewer's labourer.
Did you go to school in Bolton?
Yes.
How old were you when you left?
14.
Did you get a job?
Yes.
Doing what?
Interesting. Sign writer's assistant.
And what were you doing when war broke out?
Ah, that was, how many years later? 5 or 6 years later, that's right. I lasted 12 months, I think, with a sign writer. Didn't get on too well with him, clash of personalities, even at that young age. Joined the bleach works in Lancashire, cotton trade, bleaching and finishing of cotton goods. That's when my ideas of government and whatever were awakened. I found I was processing goods that were made in Japan, being processed in England and packaged to South America, labelled Made in England. And that just didn't seem right to me at that time when my friends were out of work. But then along came the war, and my father had told me the best thing I could do was join the Navy, otherwise I would be called up in the Army, and the best thing I could do was join the sick berth branch in the Navy. To put it bluntly, he said that's the best branch in the Navy. And I think probably one of the best, you know, because it required a different approach to probably loading shells into guns, and it was more of a personal type of branch in the Navy.
Was it easy to get into the Navy?
With the fact that my father had served in the First World War and my desire to join the Navy, and also I'd taken the precaution of getting a sick berth certificate from my local St. John Ambulance in anticipation that should I join the Navy, it might help me get into the sick berth branch. Yet, strangely enough, I went to Royal Arthur, I think it was, in Skegness, which had just opened for hostilities-only ratings who were joining the Navy. And after 50 years, there are one or two instances that stick in one's mind, and I shall never forget this one. I'd made the journey from Bolton by train to Skegness, got onto a Navy lorry which took us to the entrance of what had been a few months before Butlin's holiday camp. And over the entrance was a magnificent sign which said, "Our true intent is all for your desire." And here I was joining the Navy. Well, there we are. Anyway, when I went into Skegness, I found they put me as a prospective signalman. Well, that didn't enamour me very much to the Navy, so I saw a warrant officer who was in charge of the incoming people, and I said, "Look, I've got a sick berth a St. John Ambulance first aid certificate. Can I get into the sick bay branch?" He said, "Come and see me a little later, and I'll see what I can do." And blow me, I joined the sick berth branch there and then, after about 24 hours of being in the Navy, as it were. And soon after that, went down to R&H in Stonehurst, where 6 months training as a sick berth attendant.
Can I ask you at this stage what your attitude towards the war was when it broke out and towards the German regime?
As I think with most youngsters just turned 20 in their early 20s, I was not to wonder why. We were caught up in the leftover, I think, enthusiasm of the First World War, being working class, who had always been staunchly royalist and nationalist, not necessarily Labour or Tory, but had a sense of loyalty to one's country. We had no imagination at all of what was ahead. Death had no concept for us in the least. In a minor way, it was like the Battle of Britain lads who flew off and 10 minutes before they were having a pint of beer and 10 minutes later they were in the drink. It was all a part of the bravura of youth, which has a little concept of the real basic terribleness of life.
So I interrupted your narrative with you saying that in June 1940... you were at Stonehouse. Did you experience any of the bombing of Plymouth?
Oh, yes. 1940, the first raid on Plymouth, I think, started on October, November 1940. I mean, I was just about to leave Stonehouse Hospital to join my first ship as a sick berth attendant, which turned out to be a training period for fleet work, and I joined HMS Defiance, two wooden hulks, in the Amoirs in Plymouth for actual training as a sick berth attendant under Navy conditions, not hospital. This was the sick berth, the sick bay of HMS Defiance, under Chief Petty Officer, Surgeon Lieutenant, a couple of other SVAs like myself. And it turned out to be, as I could see, about 6 months further training under actual sick bay conditions.
Can you describe what you saw of the bombing of Plymouth?
Ah, yes. Tied up in the Amoirs, which was offered at the Navy dockyard, got a good view of generally what was happening, but my memories remain probably, I managed to get a room ashore because I wanted to be independent and quiet and have some sort of relation to normal living, so it meant that I could get ashore at 4 in the afternoon every other day and read and play tennis even with a club in Plymouth. And then early March, I think it was, in 1941, the Blitz started. I remember one night particularly going ashore. I went to the cinema, ABC I think it was, and of all things, it was Northwest Mounted Police, I think with Madeleine Carroll, I forget now. And suddenly we'd heard these bangs going on outside, and suddenly the film finished, the lights came on, the manager came on the stage, "Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, go quickly to the nearest air raid shelter, there's a very large raid taking place on Plymouth." Came out of the front of the cinema to find George Street, Cornwall Street, a sea of fire. Wondered what to do. There was no chance of the firemen combating it, it was too big. Went to an air raid shelter just alongside the cinema. Bombs dropped around us, but thank God not on the air raid shelter. And I thought, oh no, this is enough for me. If anything, I can't get back to the ship, I didn't think. But I could probably, being a sick berth attendant, do something if there was an ARP post nearby. As it turned out, I joined another one or two Navy ratings, and we were rescuing, it sounds like looting. We weren't looting, that's... No, nothing like that. What happened was there was an International Stores or a Lipton store, that's right, on fire, with stacks of sugar, butter, tea and whatever, all going up in flames. And we decided get as much out as we could and put it into the foyer of the ABC cinema. At least we saved a fair amount of food until, of course, the fires got a hold of proper. And you just had to get out. After that, I found my way to a sick first aid post somewhere in Mutley, and I saw my first dead body. Now, if anybody aged in his early 20s wants to be brought down to earth, He needs to see there in front of him the perpetration of what he's fighting about and what he's doing.
What did it look like?
It was a woman. There was no sign of... There was no mangled body. I think probably some shrapnel had gone in, and this woman was on a table. And at that time, they hadn't pulled blankets over her. She'd just been dumped there, I think. And there were others injured around and that sort of thing. All I can remember is that suddenly I saw, and I looked around, and is she dead? Yes, she's dead.
This was at Mutley Plain?
At Mutley Plain, opposite the blind school. Why do I remember that? Because, of course, the impact was so great at that time. Little did I know what was ahead of me. Anyway, going on from there, got back to the ship and got ashore again occasionally, saw the people escaping from Plymouth about 7 o'clock in the evening, taking buses and cars and lorries and what have you, up onto Roeburgh Down, or whatever it's called, up near the golf links, to get away from the intense bombing of Plymouth itself.
What was public morale like in Plymouth under the bombing, do you think?
You asked me what morale is like. Quite frankly, there was no morale. We were English. You don't have to consider your morale when you're English, do you? You might have had the odd one that cowered or was going a bit silly or something like that. But generally, the adrenaline was running in people. They were down to earth. One or two were distraught because they probably lost their houses and things like that. I never, ever saw one sign of either panic or what the hell are they doing and that sort of thing.
Did anybody ever say that we ought to give in or come to an agreement with Hitler to get it stopped?
Good God, no. Never, ever does that.
Did it make
neither in the Navy nor in the civilian people that I came across.
Did it make people want to get revenge on the Germans?
You have little time when you're concerned with self-preservation in circumstances which are dire. There's little time to start thinking about who's perpetrating this. You do, in your quieter moments, you think, my God, why, you know. I was many times after that to stop and say, what the hell am I doing here? What's it all about? You know. On this particular instance, I will quote one thing. It goes on a few months or so when I was on a ship. We'd done a Vagzo raid on Norway, Boxing Day 1941, later in the year. That's right. Just after I commissioned with Onslow. And we had a number of German prisoners that had brought off the fishing port of Vagzo. They were on board, we had to take them back, as well as our dead, but that's another story. We had to bring them back to Scapa for them to be transported to prisoner of war camps. All the ratings that were free were on the upper deck. When these German sailors were blindfolded, and soldiers, blindfolded and led down the gangway to waiting lorries. There was a petty officer up on the wing of the bridge, I think he was, probably, as what you've just asked, incensed, called out at the top of his voice, shoot the bastards. And the skipper, who was on the bridge, immediately reacted, arrest that man. And he was arrested. And this was Captain Armstrong, who you'll learn of a little later, who lost his life in the Lafori in the Med later on. Strong, beak-nosed, wonderful character, but had the power of God and practiced it. He looked at you, and he didn't look at you. He just bore holes in your eyes, you know. Wonderful. As I've said probably earlier to you, Navy discipline. The very epitome of Navy discipline. Had the man arrested... I can't remember exactly what was done to him. I think he probably lost the rate or something like that, and may have certainly lost his leave, because that was the spirit of the British Navy, as portrayed by Captain Armstrong. It was also portrayed by the petty officer who'd just gone through hell, you know. But Navy discipline, where the captain was concerned, was applied and could be. The petty officer was lacking in that little bit and suffered by reason of it.
Now, can we go on to how you first joined the Onslow in September?
After training in Defiance and getting your draft chit, as they call it, found myself on a train with the main body of the... Oh, no, the first body of the crew joining the ship, which was tied up alongside the dock in John Brown's and Clyde Bank. Strangely enough, on the same stocks that the Queen Mary and the Elizabeth had been launched. And we found ourselves aboard, preparing the ship for sea. First emergency flotilla, laid down in 39-40, modern design, wonderful ship, looked good. And if a ship looks good, she's generally good. Nobody knew anybody, but you, out of sheer necessity, you soon find out who your friends are and that sort of thing. I had my sick bay, no doctor, so I had a lot of sorting out to do and stocking the sick bay, the necessities. Wet around the ears. I'd only been in the Navy 8 months, something like that. And thrust into this situation. A crew of around 200 men, mainly, almost without exception, apart from myself and one or two others, called active service men. These were men who joined the Navy as boys and were crewing probably the second, third, or maybe fourth ship. The very heart of the Navy, but strange to a working class lad who found himself in this situation, not necessarily of his own making.
In which way were they strange to you?
The four-letter word was used in every sentence. Well, I was brought up in an atmosphere where the very idea of that word being used would have brought down the wrath of my old man right away, and certainly my mother. So then you get to these men who, it's part of their life, part of their way of living. It is an example of the manliness of, that's what they were there for. You don't come here to sit and wonder, but to F and F and F like that, you know. I find myself at times standing back a little bit. Couldn't join in because that was a anathema to me. But got on very well, ate with them and that sort of thing. But always wondered what it was all about. I found myself like Alice in Wonderland.
So were the hostilities only people less rough?
Between the ages of 14 and 20, males particularly, are prone to the formative influences of their upbringing. For hostilities only, men to be brought into the Navy indicated generally a little education, but I think more so a steadfast way of English living, which held them in good stead. A boy who's joined the Navy at 14, 15 is disciplined. He's not taught so much to think for himself. He doesn't have to. His life is ordered. He can, I think, if he sees fit, and a lot did, to advance, but it is only within the range of what he is being trained for to do. morally and spiritually, they were accepted things in the Navy. Homosexuality, up to that time, had been subject to the death penalty. I don't know whether it is these days, but it was in those days. So there was never I never came across the slightest hint of homosexuality. But conversely, I came across, which was new to me, an approach to the female, which in some respects was diabolical. Sugar and spice and all things nice. It might have been part of a sailor's dream of home and that sort of thing, but for practical purposes, I think he was basically a man and suffered the consequences.
Now, were you the sole medic on board the ship?
Yes.
So you were in complete charge of the health of the crew?
Yes, until a doctor joined, which was just before the ship sailed on her first commission. Then, of course, he just held what was required of surgery in the morning. In fact, sometimes he would ring me up, have you got anything for me this morning? I said, nothing that I can't cope with, and I'd probably go through whatever treatments I had, and he probably wouldn't need to attend. Of course, we were always on duty. As what did happen, we went from the Clyde up to Scapa, and the engineer commander was washed against depth charges and broke his thigh. What was his name? Was it? Oh, I forget now.
Doesn't make any difference.
No. So immediately the call goes out, sick berth attendant to the upper deck or something like that, and if it's serious, then the doctor is there as well. The doctor, too, incidentally, was cipher officer. Now, on board, particularly a flotilla leader, there was code and cipher. Code was mainly weather reports and naval functions and operations, which were decoded by the telegraph staff, but cipher was secret, most secret, which had to be done by an officer and had a certain cryptic formula which needed assistance, so I became assistant cipher officer with the doctor for ciphers only, not codes, and we would be called out at any hour of the day and night. Sometimes I would turn in and 10 minutes later out again because the cipher had come. I'd raise the doctor and we'd get the books out and do the messages. So for where battles are concerned and fleet movements and German movements, I was privy to information even before some of the officers. It put me in an invidious position insofar being an ordinary rating. I was very often pressed by my friends and my messmates. Now, come on, Doc, what's going on? Come on, tell us what's happening, you know. But I had taken the cure for that, because when I saw Captain Armstrong and he told me I had to assist the doctor in the cipher work, as I've just said with his piercing eyes, if you breathe one word of this to any soul, you know, he almost breathed the fire of wrath down my throat. So, of course, even if I'd have wanted to, well, you just didn't. But I think in the process, it built up between me and the crew a certain amount of respect, but also a certain amount of, not resentment. The worst thing that could happen to anybody in the Navy, is, to put it bluntly, is if you're arseholing. Well, by reason of my work, I had to work with the doctor and closely. Cipher work I was. And It didn't affect me in the least. I couldn't care less. I just tried to live my life as I saw fit within the constraints of the Navy that they put upon me and do my job as I thought fit. And I think I had the respect. Well, they must have had, because I ate with them and I never had any trouble with them.
So the ratings didn't like anybody who they thought was currying favour or sucking up to the officer.
Well, it was up to that person, like myself, to assure them or to display to them that you were doing your bloody job. I couldn't care less whether you think I'm arseholing with an officer or not. I've always had the attitude in life and since I left the Navy, as I've just said, you don't come here to sit and wonder. Come on, let's do something about whatever you're doing or whatever problem you do. There's the old saying, you know. And I found it in when I was going through Naval College. In charge of a squad of men, and you're befuddled. You don't know what the order is, and the squad is coming to the end of the parade ground, and one wag from the front shouts, "Say, for S sake, say something, even if it's only goodbye." And that sort of attitude instills in one to do something about things. And don't curry favour, because if you try and curry favour with a sailor, he has very suspicious ideas about you, you know what I mean? So, if by chance it appeared as if I was one of those up top, it's just unfortunate. To me, I was only doing my job. In fact, I would say this, from my working class background and my influence of my working class life, the touching of the neb of the cap, the attitude was still with me. Ah, yes, sir. No, sir. Three bags full, sir. You know what I mean? That attitude tended to still be with me, but deep inside, I wanted more than what I had there. So any of my shipmates who hear this, I'm sorry, lads, I only did my bloody job, like you were doing.
From your own experience in the Second World War, what did you feel was the relationship between the ratings and the officers?
Well, it was obvious to anybody who'd had any knowledge of the Navy from before Nelson's time. The British Navy particularly, more than the Army, more than the Air Force, because the Navy was a close family. You found yourself in Nelson's time on a ship for 2 years with no sight of land sometimes for months on end. Men were thrown together, and when you have people like that, you must have discipline. And still you must have today. Without discipline, you cannot defensively protect yourself and run an ordered way of defence.
But do you think that the ratings respected the officers or not?
Oh, yes, they hated their guts, but they respected them. And strange enough, an officer who did not command that respect was nothing. He was despised. He would be obeyed reluctantly. But those that commanded the respect of the ratings were respected. Captain Armstrong particularly. He was called a hook-nosed bastard, was Captain Armstrong. I've heard ratings when the ship has been heading to the sea and tossing around like a pea in a can, and even to... he couldn't be comfortable. You'd wedge your knees up against the mess table and your back against the cushion of